I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee at 1 o'clock. Would you please call a roll?
Vice Chairman Bundy. Representative Porter.
Here.
Representative Roper.
Here.
Representative James. Representative Croft.
Here.
Representative Berkowitz.
Here.
Chairman
Green. Here. We do have a quorum. Today we don't have any bills to discuss, but we have the privilege of having the Department of Public Safety here to give us an overview. And we have the commissioner, the deputy commissioner, and several of the administration here to give us that overview. And so without any further ado, Commissioner Audie, if you would care to lead off. And
thank you.
I'll preface this by there may be one of our committee that is quite familiar with what you do, but most of us, I think, will find it most enlightening because we know that you do other things and wear very attractive uniforms.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Ron Audie, Commissioner of Public Safety, and Representative Porter probably is familiar how it was done in the old days. But there's been a lot of changes. Since then. I do want to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to come and talk about the mission and the programs within the Department of Public Safety. You know, for obvious reasons, I have felt for a very long time that public safety is one of the most basic fundamental functions and services of government. I think all of the surveys and opinion polls and things that I've seen over the years certainly reinforces that public safety is one of the top one, two, or three issues in most households throughout Alaska. So in that regard, I think it is an important topic. I have with me today several of the directors and program managers, and I can tell you that I and I think the people of Alaska are extremely fortunate to have a group of managers and directors as competent, professional, and dedicated as the group that I have working for me. It's not to say that there aren't other staffs within state government that are good, but I guarantee you these people are truly professional. They make me look good all the time, and they make my job an awful lot easier. So I do want an opportunity for them, as we work through this, to just share with you in some brief comments a little bit about their particular programs. And hopefully we'll do that quickly enough that there will be some time at the end for questions or follow-ups.
Great.
When the public thinks about the Department of Public Safety, they mostly think about a uniformed trooper that they would call in an emergency, and I think we're all familiar with that. If you have not had the misfortune of calling one, you might very likely think about a DMV clerk who re-registers a vehicle or a driver's license. If you're in a fishing community, you're most likely familiar with a fish and wildlife trooper who's out there enforcing some of the commercial harvest kinds of things. And in rural Alaska, certainly the VPSO program is your first image of public safety. But I can tell you that while each of these are correct, the Department of Public Safety serves the public and the criminal justice community in just a wide variety of ways that most often the general public is not aware of. And I would just like to maybe walk through some of those very quickly and talk about them, and we'll do some follow-up with the individual directors. Things like highway patrol and accident investigation are public safety services that the public is familiar with. Criminal investigations, search and rescue operations, driver's licensing and motor vehicle registration, concealed handgun permitting, enforcement of sport fishing and hunting regulations, and criminal history background checks for employment, all areas where the public, I think, has a pretty good understanding about what public safety does. But from that point on, I can tell you that there's a huge number of services and programs that the public is not nearly as familiar with. Things like the licensing of commercial drivers, security guard licensing, support to shelters for victims of abuse and sexual assault, highway safety planning grants to local communities, plan review and inspection of commercial buildings, coordination of federal drug grants and operations of task forces around the state, enforcement of commercial fishing regulations, criminal history information to schools, hospitals, and other organizations that care for persons who are easily victimized, sex offender registration, financial aid for victims of violent crimes, staffing of the Emergency Communications Center in Anchorage, our Alaska Criminal History Repository, the automated fingerprint system, the apps and computer system that ties into the national NCIC system, the movement of prisoners to court between institutions and outside of Alaska, the service of all of our criminal and civil process, security for court facilities, provision of driver's license photographs and photo lineups to police, training of recruit police officers, both locally and with the state, training of fire department personnel, oversight of the village public safety officers, in-service training for municipal and state police officers, and crime laboratory examinations for all Alaskan law enforcement. I've probably forgotten a number of things, but I think that highlights sort of the basic program areas that make up public safety. I'm going to make just a couple of quick comments about the budget, and then we'll sort of move on, and we won't talk about that again. The operating budget. As with other state agencies, personnel costs in the department make up the greatest share of our budget, and in public safety, it's about 60% of the total budget. Although the public safety budget has grown substantially in the last 20 years, it has consistently grown less than the growth of state spending in general. This is most dramatically reflected in the decline in the number of troopers per 1,000 population. While there's no magic formula, I agree, in the last 10 years, between 1986 and 95, the ratio of troopers to population has decreased about 25%. In the capital budget, as a statewide organization, many of our operations occur in remote locations, and unlike many government operations, they have to be available 24 hours a day, or certainly whenever an emergency happens. This requires aircraft, vessels, snow machine cars, trucks to be readily available on short notice, communications and access to information. Critical to any law enforcement organization is a necessity in rural Alaska as well as downtown Anchorage. Hence the need for radios, computers, and the maintenance of our information system. Caring for this considerable store of equipment requires the basic adequate office space, storage, hangar space, and ongoing maintenance. We occupy 119 state-owned or leased structures located in 49 communities in Alaska. We operate 43 aircraft, a value of about $6 million, and the average age of those is about 25 years. We operate 19 vessels, a value of about $12 million, the average age of 16 years. To support 911 service and communication with officers, the department does operate approximately 1,500 mobile and handheld radios, dispatch consoles, and recorders statewide. To perform case reporting, hot file, interstate, and the other kinds of technical functions, there are more than 1,000 microcomputer terminals supported by 20 local area networks throughout the state. Since 1984, the state spent about $4.5 billion on its capital budget. Public safety share of that has been about $24 million, or 0.5% of the statewide total. And I can assure you, as I've traveled around the state and looked at the condition of our facilities and some of our mobile equipment, this is tremendously inadequate. The next couple of pages in the handout that I provided you is just some information that might be of interest to you about the crime trends in Alaska and what the population and policing ratios show. I'm not going to spend time with the committee going over that, but if there are questions concerning that when we get done, we'd be happy to follow up and discuss or answer those questions. The first program that I would like to walk through is the fire prevention program. We do have the director of the state fire marshal with us, and I'm pleased to introduce Craig Goodrich.
Commissioner, before you leave, I have a couple of things, if I might. Could you tell me what a hot file is?
Hot files are wanted files, or they could be flags, such as people that are required to register. They could be people that have particular writs, such as our domestic violence writ kind of hot file that we are mandated to provide for law enforcement in this state.
Is that meaning that this is something that is really high priority? Or?
It's a separate category of information with a particular focus or interest for law enforcement. Something that needs to be packaged and categorized by itself because there is some particular special interest in that particular group of individuals.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, absolutely.
Commissioner, are you talking about warrants and subpoenas? Would that fall under that category?
No. I mean, I guess warrants could be considered a hot file issue, but it would, the best example I can think of would be something like our domestic violence writ file, which we are required to keep. That is a group of individuals where you're always going to be able to go in and access the information on who has had a writ issued against them for an indefinite period of time, and that would be considered one of the hot files.
Representative Berkowitz?
But the troopers or Department of Public Safety is responsible for service of subpoenas and warrants to a large measure.
That is correct.
And do you have any idea how many subpoenas or warrants are served on a regular basis?
I think that information is contained in here, and I think we'll get to that in short order. I can tell you that, as an example, in Anchorage right now, just in that community, we have 7,000 to 9,000 unserved warrants that we're trying to work through in a backlog. We have similar backlogs in other parts of the state, so it is a considerable number. In 96, the state trooper served or cleared a little over 20,000 arrest warrants and 29,000 court writs that were served.
Just so I'm clear on the process here, and I think I'm familiar, mm-hmm. but most of this is done through judicial services, or is this also done through uniformed troopers, regular uniformed troopers?
A combination of both. Many of the warrants are served through the normal course of contacting members of the public on traffic stops, other kinds of calls, and as the trooper or local officer might routinely access the absent information network and determine that there is a warrant, it will be served at that time. We do have some resources that are dedicated specifically out of JS to do nothing but serve warrants, but the press of transporting prisoners really takes away from our effort within that unit to do it on a sustained basis.
I just want to be clear, would you feel that there's adequate resources available to serve warrants and subpoenas?
Well, I think the fact that we have the backlog that we do certainly would tell the public, and it tells us, that we're not doing nearly as well in that area as we should and could. I think when the court issues an arrest warrant, it's usually as a result of some fairly significant action. So we would like to be able to serve those in a more timely basis. I can't sit here and tell you what might be an acceptable pool of unserved warrants, but it's probably less than what we have currently.
But
if you're going to continue on this line, let's wait till afterwards. Representative Bundy?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question for the commissioner, but I can certainly wait until after if he's going to be available for questions.
I know Deputy Commissioner Smith is going to have to leave about 1:30, but...
I will be here, Mr.
You will
Chairman.
Be here. Good.
Okay. Yeah, I can... hold my questions till after testimony.
For the record, Representatives Bundy and James arrived about 1:05 after. Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, and for the record, my name is Craig Goodrich. I'm the Director of Fire Prevention in the Department of Public Safety and better known as the State Fire Marshal. Very briefly, the Fire Marshal's position was created, or the Office of the State Fire Marshal's position was created primarily for the purpose, as it says, to foster fire prevention activities in the state. However, through the 50s and the 60s, the state of Alaska experienced a rather disastrous life loss annually of 60 or 70 people a year, and that, given the reduced population, even below what it is today, was an astronomical figure. In the late 60s, then, the Fire Marshal's office was expanded considerably and given charge with the public fire education program, in addition to reviewing all plan reviews within the state. And presently, the State Fire Marshal is responsible for reviewing and acting in a quasi-fashion as the chief building official for the state of Alaska as well. So we, last year, 1996, reviewed over 1,500 plans for construction in the state, totaling a little over $1 billion. That's a pretty interesting and astounding figure. However, we don't do the full plan review function that is typically done in the several jurisdictions who have deferrals within the state, which is Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kenai, and Juneau. With, though, that very high loss of life that we were experiencing in the late 60s and 70s, with the advent of the job description that the fire marshal undertook and the plan reviews and that kind of thing, we were able to reduce significantly the loss of life in the state from fires and, in fact, the numbers of fires. And those have remained relatively constant over the last 15 to 20 years. And still, we run an average loss of life in our state. And the dollar loss, as you'll see if you look down here, that we are committing huge numbers of resources in terms of nearly $500 million last year alone was committed to the issue of fire and fire-related circumstances. Last year was a significant year, though, in that we had quite a fire loss in terms of wildland fire as well. But there are essentially three programs that the fire marshal undertakes to reduce this loss of life of property from fire. First order of business is the plan reviews, which we have been talking about. The second order of business is the public fire education program. Now, that is mandated. It is one of those things, however, that has never been funded. We don't have a public fire educator on board. And so with the climbing rate and the loss of life that we've had over the last several years, we're changing the way we're doing business. And one of the third components that the Fire Marshal's Office engages in is the enforcement arm or the inspection part of our program, where our fire marshals go out into the field and conduct inspections of the properties that exist out there, some of the 20,000 buildings. You'll see approximately a number in here of 14,500 commercial structures. We actually have responsibility for about 20,000 buildings, however, of which we can inspect approximately 8%. However, that 8% is the facilities that we targeted as being those that could produce the highest loss of life. So in that regard, we have substantially been able to accomplish what our mission was. And yet, where we are losing our lives today, last year, for example, in 1996, we had 29 lives lost to fire, all in residential facilities, and none of them had operating smoke detectors. So this is where we're putting all of our eggs now, or at least the lion's share. We are going to continue to conduct the business inspections and the inspection program that we have, but we are coupling that up with an educational component. The downside is we won't be able to inspect quite as many buildings, but we think that we'll have a higher return because individuals will be able to take the knowledge we give them during those inspection programs and take those home. So while on the one hand we won't be ticketing as many people as we have in the past, we hope to have some real positive gain because they'll take that information to their families and into their residences where they live, and we hope to get a higher payoff. Finally, the last component that the fire marshal is charged with undertaking is the education of firefighters. The fire marshal is responsible for essentially licensing all fire departments that operate within the state. If they don't register with the fire marshal's office, they don't have legally the capacity to operate and function in their communities. They need to get a search warrant before they go in and so on. So you register with the fire marshal's office and you get the benefit and the protection of the law that the statutes imply. Coupled with that, then, is the educational responsibility that goes forward with those fire departments. Now, there are four deferred jurisdictions that have fire training programs in the state. Those are, again, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kenai, and Juneau. They have training officers, but virtually all of the other 277 registered fire departments, and certainly the remaining fire departments, don't have any capacity to educate their firefighters. So we struggle continuously, and that's the big piece of the pie that we don't feel we've gotten our arms around adequately, is how to provide some type of education to those people, especially given the funding situation that we have. But we are continuing to march down that road. Looking at the statistics on the bottom of the page, in 1996, you'll see that nearly $500 million was expended toward fire, 29 lives lost. We still continue to this day to have the worst loss of life and property loss of any state in the United States, and interestingly enough, the United States has the worst statistic in the world. I'm fond of saying that barring any discovery of unknown life forms in the universe, you could say we're just about as bad as it gets. The fire marshal has statutory oversight for 321 fire departments, 277 of those are registered, and the remaining piece are very, very small organizations that come and go. It just depends on if they have people in the community to volunteer or not. Alaska is the only state that does not have an aggressive public fire education program, although we are trying to establish that right now. And in fact, through a program that we are working with Alyeska Pipeline Service Company and TAPS, we're forming a nonprofit organization called Community Safe Programs. And with that, we intend to try and get a public fire education component going out to those communities. We are also in the final stages, in the final 8 months, of getting a very broad spectrum safety community, full spectrum safety program going for communities called Risk Watch, and that we hope to have come up to speed in January of next year. And we are partnering right now with approximately 51 agencies, but we are continuing to build on that through a program called PACOS, which is the Partnership Council on Safety. And the objective of that is to get interagency organizations to reduce their costs and expenditures through improving relationships so that we don't have to send one instructor, for example, to Emonic to conduct the same training that the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is doing and that the Village Public Safety Officer is doing and all of those kind of things. We've discovered that there's quite an expenditure in that regard. In closing, we do not have any good statistics to give you. However, I would the initial flush on the arson situation in our state is horrendous. We are, for the first time, being able to generate some facts and figures on the kinds and the types of fires coming out of various communities, and believe it or not, we've never had the capacity to do this before, but we have a new computer program which has just gone into effect in December, and we are giving our fire marshals, when they go out to do their inspections, what we call a trip report, and that's what kind of fires are they seeing in those communities so that they can target those. Of the five runs that we have done so far, every single fire in the last 24 months has been juvenile arson related in those communities that we are addressing. We know that in 1995, 40% of the fatalities in our state were directly the result of juvenile arson. And we are working with CIB and Captain Casanovas to formulate and get up and running the statewide arson intervention program and task force. The first task force worked at Miller's Reach Fire, and we think we ironed out a lot of bugs on that. Although we have not been able to pin down an individual, unfortunately, but we'll see how it goes. So, barring that, are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
A rash of them, Representative Bundy.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, but first, a compliment. Every time there is a fire-related incident in my district, I think your office is communicating with my office, and I think that works well to keep the awareness up. Question came to mind when you talked about smoke detectors and all the good that they would accomplish. I know people in the fire prevention world did a marvelous job with young kids in the public schools in the Stop, Drop, and Roll program on personal fire safety, and they've done very well. For quite a period of time, various people from fire departments would come into schools and talk about that. Have you given any thought to including the smoke detector as part of that? And if you can, I know of no worse conscience than a 6 or 7 year old kid who asks their parents repeatedly, have you checked the smoke detector?
The short answer is yes. We have the Learn Not to Burn program that we are initiating. We should have that up and running in July. It's part of a broad spectrum program called SSD, Smoke Detectors, Sprinklers, and Defensible Space. We're working that with the Alaska Fire Service, which, and this is a confusing issue, they're wildland people and we're structural component. But the footprint that you lay down for education is exactly the same. If I might offer something very briefly, of 29 fatalities we had last year, none of them had operating smoke detectors. And what the CDC has discovered, and they just completed a study in Alaska, is that about 70% of the homes in Alaska do not have an operating smoke detector. We used to think it was because they took the batteries out, the kids were using the batteries ran down, they didn't replace it. The fact of the matter is their false alarms are causing people to disengage their smoke detectors. Very clearly what we have is a situation where people have installed the wrong kind of smoke detector. So our thrust now is to go with what is called a photo cell, which has a 95% less false alarm rate than the ionization detector, which most of you can find. But we are going to initiate that program as it goes, and we're going into the schools, grades K through 3. We are going into every daycare center that they have with the Learn Not to Burn program and the smoke detector issue. We are finishing, we've been targeted by, and we are in the process of receiving a grant from the National Fire Protection Association, and we've been targeted for a three-year product from the Center for Disease Control for a three-year program to hit smoke detectors in the disastrous that we have in the state.
And one to follow up, if I could, or on a different topic, do you work with the fire departments in the airports, particularly international airports? Are they in a cooperative?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, do you have any, just off the top of your head, knowledge about the schools in the state? I know every year it seems like we end up having another school burn, and that's been a very big concern of mine. But do you get a chance to inspect them? Do you have any knowledge of code upgrade and those things, what kind of a need there is out there in our schools?
Well, of course, we had the emergency regulation, which transitioned into the adoption of the regulation for sprinklers in all new construction in schools, or major remodel or modification. And so as schools are remodeling, now these are E1s, and the easy way to differentiate between an E1 and an E2 is that an E1 is a school that is designed to accommodate 50 students or more. So if the school is designed to hold, whether it does or doesn't, but if it's designed to accommodate 50 students or more, it will be an E1, and a sprinkler system will be driven. There is no retroactivity, however, so this would just be for remodels or new schools. However, I noticed that there are a couple of bills that are put in under some maintenance to schools and things like that that are on the books, and one of my concerns is that it might not include that, so we're hoping they take that into consideration. Specifically, however, are you asking me the numbers of schools that would require sprinklers?
Well, I just thought maybe you might have a general feeling as to what the need was out there. Have you inspected them?
Absolutely.
Are they all inspected?
That's part of our 8%.
Okay, that was my biggest question. Are you inspecting them? And what is the other thing is that the fires that we've had, is there any kind of a cause? Or are they different causes?
Well, there are multiple causes, but one of the things we're trying to encourage the architects to do is to separate out the heating facilities, because oil-fired furnaces simply give you a greater problem, as you probably all know, and where we're having a number of our fires is in those heating plants out there, and particularly in oil-powered heating plants. The latest fire, though, that happened in Nilchik was an electrical issue, and so that will prove to be very expensive until we get sprinklers in all of those facilities.
Thank you.
Virginia Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions for Mr. Goodrich, but I defer them, and if you want to continue with the schedule, if he's going to be here.
I will be here, absolutely.
Mr. Chair?
Virginia Berkowitz.
Do you feel that the failure to implement statewide fire prevention education program jeopardizes Alaskan lives and property?
Oh, absolutely.
And would you feel that the wiser course would be to implement that kind of program?
We are trying to do that. And we are trying to do that through a partnership with a variety of different organizations, including getting the Learn Not to Burn program, and we're trying to fund that without having to come to the legislature to say we need money for that. We went back to the legislature, to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, and got a $14,500 interim appropriation to bring on an individual just to manage the sheer number of programs we have going right now in the public fire education arena until, hopefully, we'll be able to get our foundation going, and the foundation will be able to generate enough money so that it gets its own individual operating. We may have to come back, though, for the next couple of years until we can get that to happen, but that is where we're trying to go with it. So the short answer is absolutely, and yes, we're trying to get it going.
Thank you.
I have just two very brief ones. I know some years back there was a teenager who was received an award because of the stop, drop, and roll. Apparently saved a life. Is that a program administered through your office?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the other is that you're talking about having jurisdiction over these various numbers of fighting units. How do you interface, say, with DNR that, like in the Miller's Reach fire or in a forest fire, that would be also involving local communities?
Well, we have, through this smoke detector, sprinkler, and defensible space program, defensible space implies it is the Department of Natural Resources program for 30 feet of clearance and the type of construction and things like that. We're working with a number of people over there at this time through the Partnership Council on Safety. That's one of the tracks within that organization. And public fire education, particularly as it addresses wildland and forestry and the wildland urban intermix. So one of the chairman of that particular program, in fact, which is also being sponsored by the State Fire Chiefs Association, State Firefighters Association, the Interior Chiefs, and the Mat-Su Valley Chiefs, is a full-time employee of the Department of Natural Resources stationed in Fairbanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Fire Marshal?
Thank you, Craig. The department does operate its own public safety training academy in Sitka. I can tell you that from my experience over the years, having the right equipment, spending money on a variety of things that keep you operational is like money in your pocket. Training for public safety personnel is really like money in the bank, and I think that's one of the things that distinguishes Alaskan law enforcement from many other parts of the country. A few years ago, when Deputy Commissioner Swackhammer and Commissioner Burton were here, the legislature said, look, you need to find a better way of delivering your training service. And so the Deputy Commissioner at that time and Commissioner worked out a program that they called the ALITS program at the Training Academy. And up until that time, the State Trooper Academy in Sitka was fully funded out of GF funds. It ran basically three programs. One was the training of state troopers at the recruit level. The second was the training of municipal police officers around the state, which we are required to do. Third was actually the training of BPSO positions for rural Alaska. And there was some interest on the part of the university for public safety to start training college students who wanted to come out of the training program being able to go to work and meet all of the certification requirements for police standards so that they might be hired by Palmer or Kenai or Wasilla. The administration of public safety at the time combined all of those programs, with the exception of VPSO, into one training program. ALITS, Municipal Police Academy, and State Troopers now all attend simultaneously the same training program in Sitka. The ALITS students are pay their own way through a variety of either personal funds or grant sources. Municipal police students are paid for by Laddie Shaw's Alaska Police Standards Council fund, which is funded by the surcharge on tickets. And of course, we pick up the lodging and per diem costs and minimal salary costs for DPS state trooper recruits, so that we were able to reduce the GF impact on that training program down to 68%, which is a pretty good bargain. It is a facility in Sitka that, in addition to the training programs for new officers, conducts the full range of in-service training. It contracts and provides training to countless numbers of state, federal, local agencies. It trains literally hundreds and hundreds of people every year. They do a tremendous job. For anybody who's ever over in the Sitka area, I would encourage you to stop in. It's an old building that we've got a lot of pride in, and they do spend a great deal of time of keeping it up, and it is worth visiting.
Are you moving on from the Public Safety Training Academy?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir.
May I ask a just a question, and maybe a suggestion. The next time we're weathered out of Juneau and in Sitka, maybe the chairman could take us on a tour of this facility.
I'd rather go to the pot shop.
A concern of mine is now the VPSOs, they do go through the firearm training system, and they have firearm safety training, do they?
The VPSOs are not armed for the most part in communities. I would say that they have probably limited firearms training.
And I'm not looking at proficiency, I'm looking at the safety aspect, and so they have some limited training in firearm safety. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask the question, I'm very concerned about the high level firearm accidents throughout the state, particularly in the rural areas, hunting accidents, and I'm looking into the notion that perhaps some mandatory firearm safety through the Hunter Ed programs ought to be introduced in Alaska. And one of the immediate questions is the availability of instructors, and I'm wondering if, from their experience at the academy, would they have a minimal amount of firearm safety experience that they might then be able to share this information with others?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, I don't believe that the training that they would receive at the academy probably would prepare them to act in the capacity of an instructor or to put on a training program at this point. I certainly wouldn't rule that out as a possibility, because the VPSO, as you'll hear when Colonel Godfrey sits down, is really designed to be a generalist public safety entity in these communities. Very little of their focus is supposed to be law enforcement. It is the EMT coordinator, the search and rescue coordinator, the fire person. And if there are other kinds of public safety needs in those communities, certainly that is a role for the VPSO. Right now, I don't think most of them would be necessarily prepared for that role, but it's something we can certainly talk about.
As a coordinator, I mean, they have a role in coordinating these other public safety issues. They might indeed then be able to have a role in coordinating this, if it were.
That is a possibility, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
The State Crime Lab, located in Anchorage, next door to the headquarters building for the Alaska State Troopers and Fish and Wildlife Protection, is a tremendous asset for law enforcement in the state. It provides forensic services with scientists specialized in serology, toxicology, chemical analysis, firearm, tool mark, trace evidence, wildlife, and latent fingerprint casework. The scientists that have worked there have distinguished themselves nationally and internationally in publications they've written. They've been asked to speak at many very renowned symposiums over the years. And the crime lab actually grew out of a change in policy by the federal government. When Representative Porter and I were officers on the street, most states sent all of their evidence, whether it was trace evidence from a crime scene, serology kinds of tests, or even fingerprints, to the FBI laboratory in Washington, D.C. But as the volume of work came in from local communities, the FBI finally held up their hand one day and said, look, we just can't do it. You're going to have to start developing your own either regional labs or state labs. And that really was the impetus that caused Alaska to start the Scientific Crime Laboratory. They do a tremendous job. Unlike the controversy that we saw in the recently on TV concerning one of the laboratories in California, this one is without question one of the highest caliber of its kind anywhere. It was recently certified and accredited. Only 25% of the labs in the nation have been able to achieve that standard, and this is just as a result of a real effort on their part. In 1996, the crime laboratory became, as I said, fully accredited. In 96, there were over 3,400 criminal cases submitted to the crime lab for examination, and of those, about 65% were from local communities. The Scientific Crime Laboratory is able to conduct forensic DNA testing, recently received a grant for $129,000 from NIJ to improve the equipment capability for DNA testing. And one item of note, a super glue fuming rod, a handheld device invented by the crime lab to process crime scenes. It's certainly a little more complicated than that, but it was developed by personnel of the crime lab and is one of those instruments now that is just a tremendous tool for law enforcement worldwide. Is marketed by the 3M company. Civil Air Patrol is...
Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
While we're still on that, I'm sorry. How do you, in the state organization, interface with the municipalities? For example, I know that there is, it sounds like a similar type lab in Anchorage. I don't know about the other cities, but how do you determine who's going to handle what?
Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the possibility that, as an example, the Anchorage Police Department has some of their own laboratory capabilities?
Mm-hmm.
It's up to the individual agencies where and how they submit evidence or things needing some kind of an analysis or test. The Anchorage Police Department does some of their own in-house fingerprint work. They do have some comparison microscopes and probably have at least the capability of doing some initial in-house kinds of comparisons or screenings. But Anchorage, out of the 65% of the workload statewide that is generated from local communities, most of that is from the Anchorage Police Department. Because they do not have, nor would you expect them to have, the really technical capabilities to conduct some of the more complicated scientific kinds of tests. Anchorage does a good job, but I don't think they really would want to get into the laboratory business. They do what they can in-house, which is great. takes that burden off the state crime lab, but most of their work does go to the crime laboratory.
Yes. Excuse me.
Charge the municipalities for those testing?
Mr. Chairman, no, we do not. I might add that most of those tests are in support of state charges on issues that are being prosecuted by the local district attorney's office somewhere. If we did charge local communities, many of them simply would not have the resources to pay for those kinds of things. And I would hate to see a small department not be able or not want to submit all of the potential kinds of tests to the state crime laboratory because they're worried about whether or not they could pay for it.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Audie, I'm sure you're aware there's plans afoot to develop a statewide medical testing facility and laboratory adjacent to the scientific crime lab on Tudor Road in Anchorage. Could you tell me your opinion of what synergies and what help that would give your crime lab if that other laboratory were there and vice versa?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rokeberg, I'm probably not as familiar with the total needs of that particular lab as some others might be, but I can tell you the component I am familiar with is the space and the ability for the state medical examiner to conduct examination and autopsies. Right now, that's being done in a very haphazard manner within our crime lab, which it never really was intended to do. And we're anxious to see them get a much better facility for the criminal autopsies and the ability to examine and try to provide identification of people who are unknown, whose remains are recovered. So that part of it we are familiar with. The medical examiner interfaces very closely with both the state troopers and the Anchorage Police Department. So I like the location right adjacent to our own particular crime lab. Beyond the medical examiner kinds of things, quite honestly, I couldn't sit here and tell you what they do, so I couldn't comment beyond that point.
Just to follow up then, you're suggesting, Mr. Commissioner, that the construction of that laboratory and the relocation of the medical examiner out of it will free up additional space for the crime lab itself, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. Right now, we are really anxious to try to do a better job, as an example, in our DNA testing. We are storing samples, but they're really not going to do us any good if we don't start testing and doing some other kinds of things. Really don't have the space to really undertake that function right now, and you know, we're not suggesting that we boot the medical examiner out, because that is also critically important to our criminal investigations, but we're anxious to see them get their own particular space for that function.
Thank you, Mr. Representative James.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one question, and it has to do with this device invented at the crime lab for developing fingerprints, receiving international recognition and is in commercial production. And my question is, who gets the royalties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, you know, that was a controversy that raged for some time. I think the crime lab felt like there should have been some way for the state to receive some royalties on this. I'm not entirely sure that the matter is totally settled, but it's my understanding that as this was sort of pursued and discussed with the Attorney General's office, it looked like it was less likely that the state could prevail in that. But so no one is presently, is a short answer.
But just quick follow-up on that. It might be that the reason I'm asking this is it might be that the state ought to set up a separate organization or corporation like the university has, that whenever some of the state employees, which might ought to be encouraged to do those kinds of things, then we all could share, including the person who was the innovative one.
Chairman, Representative James, if there was a way for that to occur, and I presume there must be, I would support it 100%, because this was a very contentious issue with the crime lab personnel who worked very hard to develop that process, and it is a wonderful tool for law enforcement.
Private industry has that, by the way, that at least if you're considered an engineer, you sign that right away. Anything discovered while in the employ of XYZ belongs to XYZ.
Well, and if I may, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I think that there's a lot of innovation available. There's a lot of thought process out there by employees. They are the ones, that's where things get to happen. Those are the people who are most able to come up with new ideas. And anything we could do to encourage them in that direction, I think, is a real wise decision.
Mr. Chairman, you know, one final comment. Representative James, I could not agree with you more. I know that there are technicians within the Anchorage Police Department working in conjunction with the crime lab that have just recently developed the ability to lift fingerprints off of
Thank you.
Civil Air Patrol is a support organization that, quite frankly, public safety really could not operate very efficiently or effectively without their presence. They are a federally chartered civilian authority of the U.S. Air Force. They receive both federal and state funding. The Department of Public Safety is the department within state government that is responsible for administering the state funds appropriated to the Civil Air Patrol. If CAP did not exist, the state would incur substantial cost replicating the search capabilities. Just to highlight their presence in this state, they own 39 aircraft, they have 120 volunteers, 20 organized squadrons statewide. They have accounted for, during this past year, 71% of all search and rescue flying hours, 63% of all of the searches. 907 sorties, a little over 2,000 hours, and in 95, 67 persons were rescued as a result of their efforts. The Highway Safety Planning Agency is the entity that a couple of years ago the ICE-T funds were going to because the state was not meeting all of the federal mandates. So this entity received probably an additional $4 to $5 million, which was passed through to local communities in the form of grants. That money has gone away, but they're still in the grant business, still with the same mission and charge. And I'd like to introduce Mary Moran, the director of our Highway Safety Planning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Moran. I'm the director of the Highway Safety Planning Agency. We are definitely one of the smaller portions of the Department of Public Safety, in fact, quite a bit smaller. We are a staff of about 3 to 4 people. It depends upon, varies from time to time. We're federally funded. We work within the state, but we're a federally funded agency. Our mission is to enhance the health and well-being of the people of Alaska through a program to save lives and prevent injuries on Alaska Highway Network. I think we all know, or should all know, that motor vehicle injuries are the leading cause of all injuries in the state for persons between the ages of 1 and 55. Our role is to prevent as many of those injuries as we can. We also try to eliminate as many highway fatalities as we can whenever possible. To this end, we use our federal funding to work with agencies around the state. We work with police departments. We work with community groups. We work with school districts in any sort of a program that in some way affects highway safety, whether it be through an alcohol program, a learning how to drive type of program of one sort or another, a peer-to-peer group where kids go out and show other kids what happens when you drink and drive, that sort of thing. Most of our money goes towards these type of programs in one sort or another. I believe last year we used about $1.25 million worth of funding to programs in this area. We do programs all around the state, and we work within our own state guidelines of high-risk drivers, Anchorage area in general, because Anchorage area seems to have a little bit of everything, all the programs. If anything's going to be wrong, you can find it in Anchorage. Occupant protection, which is always a big issue, and working with principal arterial areas such as the Seward Highway, the Parks Highway, those kind of areas coming into the state. They all seem to have their own problems that are significant to those areas and not to other areas. We also work with community groups to do bike rodeos, safe kids programs, health fairs, any kind of thing where we can go and show someone how to wear a seatbelt, to remind people to wear their seatbelts, show a young mother how to put in a car seat correctly in her car, all those things that no one else does. Somebody has to do it where the people get out there and do it. You never hear from us very much because you shouldn't. We should be the people that are working behind the lines, working with other agencies. We try and let other agencies have as much of the credit for their programs as possible. We basically help them fund their programs. We also fund police departments, law enforcement agencies around the state, overtime programs for highway programs, highway overtime programs for holidays, for instance. Like this past year, we actually did quite well. Colonel Godfrey was very happy to hear this. I know that we managed to get through Memorial Day, Labor Day, 4th of July, and Thanksgiving weekends with no fatalities, throughout the four holidays. We almost made it through Christmas and New Year's, but there were a couple people at the last minute had to ruin that one for us. But we almost made it. That was with our funding to help fund overtime enforcement for the troopers. We also worked with special promotions programs throughout different holidays to, there again, promote the idea, don't drink and drive, wear your seat belts, and so on and so forth. That is what we do. Recently, in fact, last week, a friend of mine in Fairbanks was seriously injured in a car accident. A young driver, teenage driver, drove out in front of her on an icy street. He was killed. she's still in serious condition in the hospital. It was took, oh gosh, at least an hour to cut her out of that car on a cold winter day in Fairbanks. If perhaps some of our programs had been more in effect there, that wouldn't have happened. Perhaps the youthful driver may have thought about it a little bit before driving out in the middle of the street. Who knows? But those are the kind of things that we do. Just for your own benefit, this weekend, I think it's Saturday, there's a Safe Kids program going on here at Centennial Hall. If you'd like to see an idea of what we do and what all the other health and social service type people do working with Safe Kids here in the community, it's an all-day program, and they always have glad to have people come down and see what goes on there. Our program resources are directed to state-identified areas. Within the state-identified areas, we also have federal program. We work within a series of federal program areas: alcohol and other drugs, occupant protection, police traffic services, emergency medical services, traffic records, pedestrian and bicycle safety, and roadway safety. These are the areas that we find the most emphasis. Our emphasis goes through that areas. The state and the federal government is happy to have us work within those. We work through the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, Traffic Administration, excuse me, I always get that one confused. We collaborate with local communities. We try and set up little groups within the community. It's not our, we aren't the people who solve the problems. It's the people in the individual communities who have to solve the problems that they have in their communities. They know their problems better than we do. They can come to us and say, well, we know that, you know, there's this area problem. We'd kind of like to do something about it. We say, okay, you guys come up with a way that we can solve this. And they say, yes, we do. And I say, fine, okay. Perhaps this is something that we can help fund, and we work through their programs. So it's basically what we do. We are the people who work within the department. We're kind of the good guys in the department. We're the ones who actually, at the end of the day, we can go home and say, we did something good today. We don't do bad things. Not that anybody does. But we're the people who try and keep other people from dying from on a day-to-day basis. And it's rather a nice feeling to be able to do that. Thank you.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moran.
Yes.
It's my understanding that there's no formal driver's education program in the state for high school students.
That's correct.
Do you know how many other states are similarly lacking?
To the chair, I'm not really sure how many other programs lack driver education. For some reason, driver education seems to be one of those areas that people have taken on for themselves, as opposed to when all of us were kids and you had to take driver training classes. I could look it up for you. I honestly don't know at the moment. All I know is that because there isn't a driver training program, there's basic behavioral patterns involved with driving that teenagers don't learn, because you don't, it's the kind of thing you don't learn if someone doesn't tell you how to do it. You can go out and have your friends teach you how to drive. You can drive the car, not a problem. But who teaches you that it's proper behavior to stop when the light turns yellow and not try to run through it and wait till it turns red? You know, who teaches you that you have to be careful and look on both sides as it's late at night or whatever, it's road is slippery? There's no one to teach you that anymore. Part of that is being done through some of the programs that we fund, but otherwise, no. There's very little of that going on, except for private programs.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mary. I'd like to introduce Lottie Shaw from the Alaska Police Standards Council. Mr. Shaw.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Lottie Shaw. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Police Standards Council. The Council establishes and enforces minimum hiring standards for police, corrections, probation, and parole officers. We also provide entry-level training, We support in-service training and certify individual officers, the law enforcement training instructors, training facilities, and courses that meet our acceptable standards. In 1994, the legislature overwhelmingly supported establishment of House Bill 319, which was the Alaska Police Standards Training Fund. And with this fund, which was established to put a surcharge on all traffic violations statewide, we were able to put in place huge in-service training support and a basic level training support that has never been supported before under police standards. I also work directly with the municipal chiefs statewide, the colonel of the Alaska State Troopers, and support all training that is put on by those departments. And in addition to the support for the municipal police departments, we also work with the state troopers in supporting the Village Public Safety Training Program. A good part of the support for the legislation was in support of training for law enforcement statewide, both the Village Public Safety Program, the municipal program, and the state trooper support program. We've been able to double our basic level support at the academy in Sitka, and we're projecting this year to have enough funds to support every agency in some fashion regionally. We've tried to break down the state regionally into four major regions and bring most of the departments into a specific area of the region and support them. We also have been supporting community policing programs that we've been working on as a grant for a sideline, and we have been able to hire a training coordinator. A retired FBI agent is now working for us, and since we have hired him and since we have established these funds in place for training, we have been inundated with requests for training. We've already put people on list for academies in September. We start our next academy in March. We're giving a full service in-service training in February, and it looks like we're going to have to increase more of the basic level training because we're already turning people away from the training that we're starting to support. And that's pretty much my program.
Can you accomplish more training with the same amount of funding, or will you have to be adding something to licenses? Or tickets, I'm sorry.
No, I think we're going to be doing well right now. We're just establishing most of what we're doing, Mr. Chairman. And it's the growth process right now is sort of overwhelming us, and so we're having to take it basically one training scenario at a time, and I think we're going to be okay. As you all know, our general funds were deleted by 50%, and so we're having to cover a part of our administrative costs for police standards from those surcharge funds as well. So that deleted a little bit, but we can spend every dime that we have very easily and not give the full support that the state probably deserves. As you know, funding has been cut in many areas, and for us to be able to support the basic training alone at $5,600 per person, we could easily increase that, but with the confines of budget, we've been able to double it, and we're pretty happy with that.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Porter.
Thank you. Laddie, as you recall, during the discussion on the bill that passed the surcharge, there was some concern at Anchorage that recognizing they provide their own academy training and fund their own academy training, that they get their bang for their buck, so to speak, out of the in-service type opportunities. Has that seemed to have been being fulfilled all right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, yes, it does, and we've been able to use the Anchorage Academy for major in-service training, working with the Academy staff in providing training to other municipalities, and also supporting in-service training from grant projects that we're working with the Police Standards Council, and training that is above and beyond what is provided by the Anchorage Police Department.
Representative Bundy.
Thank you. You indicate here that funds are provided by the surcharge, but you also said there's a GF, or general fund, component to your budget. What's the percentage?
The general fund component to our budget is $129,000.
And how does that, and the compared to the $600,000 you're getting in the surcharge?
The $600,000 is strictly surcharge. The $130,000 addition to that is the general fund.
Yeah, and it's for the total budget of?
$730,000.
Okay. And and then there is no charge back to any community for providing this service?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bundy, no, there is not.
Well, I hope you'll come to us if you need more money. We can talk about surcharges, user fees, if you rather.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Auto reader is a totally bad.
I didn't say that.
Chairman, Representative Porter, we haven't received any photo radar money yet.
I'm happy to hear him say yet.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to because they might have a couple of other meetings to go to, skip to the Alaska State Troopers. We will cover these other topics, but I would like to skip to the Alaska State Troopers and Fish and Wildlife. I do have the two directors here, and I know that we're getting to the point where they're going to be at another meeting pretty soon. So I would like Colonel Glenn Godfrey from the State Troopers to come up. I would point out that while it's not a reflection on his program, he is wearing socks that say left and right, and he does have them on the right foot.
You needed that, didn't you?
Mr. Chair.
Before the colonel gets started, I just think it's appropriate to say that he's taking shots at everybody today. So
oh.
There's some days you just don't want to make decisions. Thank you for allowing me to make a presentation today. I'd like to touch upon some statistics that might be beneficial, especially to the new members of the committee on some of the activities the Alaska State Troopers are involved in. The troopers currently have are divided in first off into six detachments throughout the state of Alaska. Each detachment is commanded by either a captain or a lieutenant, depending on the size of that particular detachment. Within the detachments are what we call outposts, which may be manned by as few as one trooper, and some two or three, and they go up to larger detachments such as Fairbanks and Anchorage, who have a good majority of the positions on the highway system. We have currently 28 positions that have been closed in the state. Out of the 34, we have 34 outposts at this time. There have been 28 outposts that have been closed in the state because of budget constraints. The troopers enforce the law, prevent and detect crime, and protect life and property throughout the state, except our authority is not automatic in the McKinley National Park. That's by invitation only by the Park Service, but the Park Service is not bashful about inviting us in on complex investigations, search and rescue, so quite often we are called into the park, but we don't routinely patrol it or provide that service unless they request us to do so. And in addition to the highly visible uniformed patrol troopers are also assigned to specialized major crimes, sexual assault, white collar crimes, missing persons, narcotics and alcohol investigation units, as well as to provide oversight of the village public safety officers. What I've realized as a director of the state troopers in the last couple of years, and which I really didn't have that much insight into before I took the position, is the amount of service and support we give to the smaller police departments throughout the state of Alaska. Probably at least once or twice a month, we're called upon to assist the smaller police departments with our expertise from our Criminal Investigation Bureau, undercover narcotics or bootlegging cases, search and rescues, prisoner transport, and a variety of matters. But it is a direct support to those municipal police departments throughout the state that have become to depend upon us, and we feel a deep obligation to them to assist them to the best of our ability. The licensing section within the division is responsible for administering the security guard licensing, sex offender registration, and concealed handgun permit programs. Our specialized traffic enforcement program, STEP Team, utilizes the latest in radar and speed measuring technologies in an intense effort aimed at reducing injury and fatality traffic crashes. We were very proud of this last year, as Mary Moran indicated earlier, to go through those holidays without a fatality in the state. That was unique throughout the whole United States. National Highway Transportation Agency was very interested in how we accomplished that by the aggressive enforcement, by the publicity going out, and through the federal funding, we were able to accomplish that major goal that received national recognition, along with not only the Alaska State Troopers, but we received support on those programs from the Anchorage Police Department and other police departments that were willing to participate with us. The Department of Public Safety instituted open recruitment year-round this last year, and this open recruitment is very important to us because it's going to allow applicants to be hired to fill vacancies as they come open. We were finding out that you have a group of people in their early to late 20s. We'd approach, they'd be out of college or wondering what they're going to do with their life at that point in time, and we'd have troopers in the field telling them, why don't you look at this profession? It's a great profession. You get a lot of self-satisfaction, and it's a good career to travel around the state because we are reassigned throughout our careers. But they'd get excited about it and say, well, yeah, I'd like to do that. Where do I apply? You say, well, we're not going to open recruitment for another couple of years. And then they go somewhere else, like to the Anchorage Police Department. And I think, you know, once we get the publicity out on this in the next couple of years, I think it's going to be real beneficial to this division and to the citizens of the state of Alaska, having constant open recruitment where you can apply. We'll administer the test in a matter of a couple months and try to get you on the register. As of January 1997, 1,385 persons have registered as sex offenders. Enforcement actions are being taken against persons required to register who have failed to do so. To date, 5,827 concealed handgun permits have been issued to Alaskans. 41 applications were denied due to disqualifying criminal histories, and 7 permits have been revoked due to recent criminal convictions. This one area that I want to talk about briefly right now is search and rescue. This is a major part of the Alaska State Trooper's responsibility by statute, and it's not only major as far as the importance of saving lives, it's major as far as the budget and the costs involved in it, and our interaction once again with other agencies such as Civil Air Patrol, volunteer search and rescue groups, and our role quite often is just coordination and being there to help facilitate the rescues. In 1996, the Department of Public Safety participated in 181 search and rescue operations, saved or assisted 302 people, recovered 37 deceased victims, and searched for 5 victims who were not located. In FY96, state troopers served or cleared 20,065 arrest warrants and 29,630 court writs. The state troopers also administer the Village Public Safety Officers Program, which involves oversight, training, and direct supervision of the VPSO positions located in rural communities, and we'll be talking about that a little later in the program here. There are 124 authorized positions in the state. I just want to touch upon a couple other stats before we go into the VPSO program. In fiscal year 1996, the troopers handled nearly 84,602 reported offenses. We investigated almost 4,000 traffic accidents, issued nearly 35,815 traffic citations. A good portion of them go into that surcharge. Investigated 527 incidents involving death. And this is another statistic that's very, very time-consuming and very important to us, naturally, is investigating 527 death investigations in a year period. That's a lot of bodies that the troopers are responsible for determining the cause of death and interacting with the families on those incidents. We drove over 4 million miles, flew over 2,000 hours in support of the AST mission. We We serve many types of court process in addition to the ones we talked about already. We serve the arrest warrants, the subpoenas, writs of assistance, restraining orders, garnishments, and those types. We're called upon those to serve those, especially in areas where there are no civil process servers. In the post where we currently have troopers in the outpost, there are quite often no process servers, so the troopers are responsible for all services. We provide public education and crime prevention services such as safety bear visits to schools in an effort to reduce alcohol and drug use and the numbers of accidental deaths and injuries. And I believe the troopers or the village public safety officers, as a program progresses, can take a look at areas like a gun safety, hunter gun safety. We've worked with children in wearing life vests in the boats in the rural villages throughout Alaska. So we are trying to do the best we can with the VPSOs in order to do public safety type of services that would prevent injury and death, regardless of what the way to go about that is something that we're very interested in, whether it's directly related to law enforcement and police or not. We maintain a program called the Village Public Safety Officer Program, and I don't know if the commissioner wanted to give a introduction into that now or...
Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Bundy.
Yes, sir. If I might, before we go on, a couple of questions. On the concealed handgun permits, the seven permits that were revoked, do you know if that was for criminal activity involving handguns?
I believe the majority of those were for criminal activity, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if all of them were or not.
Obviously, the vast majority are law-abiding citizens, however. Yeah.
The indications are definitely that, yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. I think they all wanted to weigh in.
I believe, I understood your question to be, was the handgun used in the seven incidents that caused that? My
person.
Understanding is that no, there may have been other crimes that they committed that would cause them to lose the handgun permit, but I'm not aware of any.
No.
Off the top of my head that the handgun was used in a crime. Yeah. That resulted then in permitting.
In losing it. So it's criminal activity.
Go through the chair.
Excuse me, sir. Before he uses his concealed. An additional question, and this is asking for just pure speculation on your part, but it kind of set off some bells when you said you are allowed to enforce, you, the state troopers, are allowed to enforce law in Denali, McKinley, by invitation only.
Right.
If the sovereignty issue would come into being where we'd have sovereign nations, would then the state troopers be able to enforce laws in those areas only by invitation?
Well, currently we're enforcing them everywhere, and we would get direction from the Attorney General's office on enforcement in sovereign areas, because you have the issues like in the lower 48, for example, as far as in those areas that are Indian country where the enforcement is against their own people and not Caucasian people that might be in the village, and we'd have to get guidance and support on exactly on how that would occur. I don't have a definite answer to that. We'd seek guidance from the Attorney General's office.
Representative Porter? Is that basically the relationship you have in Metlakatla now?
Yeah, once again, in Metlakatla, we only go into Metlakatla upon invitation by that police department, and on occasion they do call us for some specific technical support, but for the most part they take care of their own enforcement. That's correct.
In an area like Metlakatla now, they don't have VPSOs as we know them in other villages.
No, that's correct. They have the Metlakatla reservation has its own police force, independent of any state force.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Colonel, can you just kind of ballpark estimate the impact of the Anchorage Police Department taking over the Hillside Services on the FY-97, FY-98, and on your detachment in Anchorage?
We have taken cuts in the past regarding the Hillside area. We have a handful of troopers that have to provide a tremendous amount of support currently in the Anchorage area, and we're leaving that group of troopers there. That's to provide support for prisoner transport. That's to provide the investigation support, like I said earlier, to the police departments. It's not uncommon for a suspect, a defendant, a victim to come into Anchorage after hours on the weekends in the middle of the night, going to perhaps the PHS hospital for some type of medical reasons, or trying to escape authorities in other areas of the state. So those troopers in that service unit will provide that support. They'll continue to provide support for the search and rescue in the Anchorage Bowl area. We do have a helicopter. We have a specialized enforcement team that utilizes in specific types of search and rescue. So serving the thousands of warrants in the Anchorage area right now that aren't being serviced, that we have a responsibility to serve. So there's an awful lot of duties and responsibilities that the troopers still have to be responsible for in the Anchorage area, and to include the Seward Highway down into the Girdwood area. We have a definite problem with the Seward Highway. We just had a tragic accident here this week that most people are aware of, with a two-year-old child. So we're trying to focus more enforcement efforts on the Seward Highway into the Girdwood area at this time also.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, there's a fairly recent study, as I understand, that basically indicated that troopers were 50% understaffed statewide. Would you estimate that APD's expansion into Hillside is going to have any major effect on the understaffing for the troopers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berkowitz, no, it's not going to have much of an impact simply because ever since we've been put in the position to provide a minimum amount of service to the Hillside, that's what we've done. We've only rolled up there on serious types of calls and incidents, and at times we were in a position where we didn't even have a patrol trooper to do that. The lieutenant or the captain might have to respond as a patrol officer. So we have purposely tried to stay off the Hillside to the best of our ability, and so it isn't creating a major change for us at this time.
Representative Berkowitz.
So your position would be then that the troopers are statewide still severely understaffed?
Mr. Green, Representative Berkowitz, I believe we are understaffed statewide.
Any other questions?
I'd like to give a brief overview of the Village Public Safety Officer Program. I'm fairly familiar with this program since it was started in 1979 when I was stationed in Bethel as a pilot program, and we weren't utilizing funds from the state at the time when it was federal funding. It was such a positive program that it's expanded from just a handful of VPSOs to the current 124 positions currently in the state of Alaska. And we currently have 94 positions that are funded. The VPSO program responds to public safety needs by dealing with a variety of law enforcement support duties, emergency medical services, search and rescue missions, fire prevention activities, and organized firefighting efforts. VPSOs are employees of the native regional nonprofit corporations. They are not employees of the state of Alaska. We the troopers are not their supervisors. The troopers provide technical expertise in areas of public safety and law enforcement issues, and we do provide the basic and ongoing training for the VPSOs. The regional nonprofits work cooperatively with the troopers to direct the daily activities of VPSOs in working with the village leaders. Also, the VPSOs are in a position where we attempt to the best of our ability and the nonprofit's ability to let the individual communities set up the priorities of enforcement and public safety issues for the VPSOs, so long as naturally they're not violating the policies, procedures, or laws. And so there is a lot of input from the individual communities as to what they see the role of their VPSO being. They are not police officers. The vast majority of the VPSOs are not armed. They act as the eyes and ears of the troopers in remote villages, where they help to maintain order. They organize volunteer fire departments, alleviate safety threats, and handle certain minor misdemeanor offenses. They also are very much involved in coordination of search and rescues in their villages, utilizing the local resources for search and rescues. The oversight troopers routinely travel to the villages, helping VPSOs in providing training in subjects such as hypothermia, report writing, search and rescue, emergency medical activities, and other associated public safety training necessities. And the close working relationship developed between the trooper and the VPSO helps the VPSO in dealing with the demands and the pressures of their duties. I've always said that it's one of the most difficult public safety type of duties that you could imagine, trying to be a public safety officer in a community where you might have 50, 75, 100, 200 people. And if you're married to an individual in that community, between the two of you, there's chances of being related to everybody in the community is astronomical. So there is a tremendous amount of pressure on the individual VPSOs, and the troopers and the nonprofits understand that and try to give them the expert or the support in the, to dealing with those types of problems and bringing them out of the village at times when things get a little too difficult. And the troopers do spend a lot of time talking to the individual councils when it gets to that point, trying to keep the turnover down. And the VPSOs responded to more than 9,100 requests for service in 1996. In 1995, 29 Alaskans received 8 weeks of basic VPSO training at our Public Safety Training Academy in Sitka. In 1996, 15 VPSOs attended the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Training held in Anchorage. And this was a two-week, very intense training where we brought instructors up in the DARE program from Arizona. And they were very, very impressed with the dedication of the VPSOs attending that that program. And since then, the VPSOs have gone back out into the rural areas and are now instructing in the DARE program. And we're very proud of what they've accomplished with that program up to now. They are capable and able to train in specific programs throughout the state. Quite often, a lot of that is left up to the individual councils and the VPSOs as to what their comfort zone is. Some of them are absolutely outstanding instructors and trainers. Some aren't comfortable with that and don't approach it with the zeal of others.
They're not state employees. They're funded by the state. What happens if they're put upon by their own people and injured?
Mr. Chair, the VPSOs are trained in officer safety type of situations without weapons, soft and hard hand techniques. They do carry a capstan. They are trained in those areas. Less than lethal force training. We strongly advise them any time where there's a situation where there might be a weapon involved of any kind to try to secure the area, have people stay in a residence, and get on the phone to us immediately. And they've done an outstanding job in doing that. Almost without fail, we're able to accomplish that and have the troopers go in and take care of those hostile situations. That potential naturally is always out there. The nonprofits are aware of it, the VPSOs are aware of it, and the Alaska State Troopers are aware of it. But at this time, the majority of the nonprofits that I've talked to in my career when I ran the program were very, very hesitant to arm the VPSOs. They like the image that they project at this time as an overall rounded-off VPSO and not the local town cop to take care of law enforcement problems only.
Representative Croft?
I guess following up on that question, have there ever been suits against either the state or the regional nonprofits for the actions of the VPSOs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Croft, yes, there has been. We have some that have been settled. There are some that are currently ongoing issues regarding the actions of the VPSOs, and naturally our Attorney General's office is involved in them, along with the other attorneys with the nonprofit corporation and the individuals bringing suit, and they work them through accordingly and quite often come to some type of a settlement.
Follow up?
Just to follow up, if I can. So that they sued both the state and the regional nonprofit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Croft, that's correct. There have been cases such as that in the past.
Representative Rookwood?
Mr. Chairman, Colonel Gottfried, kind of go back one step here. How many troopers do you have now, and how many are authorized?
We have, I believe there's 258 positions available in the state, if I'm not mistaken, and we've got 22 positions currently vacant at this time.
Mr. Chairman, follow up there. You mentioned the DARE program. that the VSOPs attended? How many troopers attended that?
We had, in that particular program, I believe we had one trooper attending that at that time.
And follow-up, Mr. Chairman, the DARE program, I think, is a very interesting program. I'm familiar with it, but it seems to be having trouble getting started, particularly in the Anchorage area. Is there a problem with leadership of that, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkenberg, I'm not familiar with the problems in the Anchorage area. We have instituted the, last year we instituted the DARE program in the Tok area with the trooper, and we currently have the other trooper that was changed in it, or trained in it, was assigned to our Aleutian Chain area and is trying to get something off the ground in that area. As far as in the Anchorage area, the DARE program would be administered in that area by the Anchorage Police Department, and I'm not familiar with what's going on with that program in the Anchorage Bowl area at this time.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the VPSO, the chairman's question struck a question and sparked a question in me, and I see the VPSO is kind of either fish or fowl. They're trained by the state but employed by regional corporation. Now, should they be injured or should they be involved in some malfeasance in office, who is the ultimate person that's liable? Is it the state or the corporation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bundy, that's an issue that is ongoing with the state of Alaska and the Village Public Safety Officer Program and the nonprofits. Naturally, they are insured to a certain degree. And depending on what the incident or the circumstances would be, there are certain areas that we train them in, like I said earlier, in officer safety, less than lethal force. If there was a situation where it was attributed to some type of training, naturally the state could be liable for that. If it was something that they were doing that they were taught not to do, and did something, you know, extremely negligent, then once again, I think that would be something the attorneys would have to take a look at, and they have done that in the past.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and then if they were injured on the job, you know, driving snow machine, just an accident, it wasn't the matter of neglect, but they have a serious medical problem now, and they need compensation for that.
Well, once again, they are Mr. Chair, Representative Bundy, they are technically speaking employees of the nonprofit corporations, and they're not currently covered by the state through risk management.
Okay. Commissioner, you have something you'd like to add to this?
Chairman, Representative Bundy, yeah, just to follow up on that, they are employed by the nonprofits, and they're covered under whatever medical coverage that particular nonprofit elects to apply, and I think it varies between the different nonprofits, but in the 2 years that I've been here, I'm not aware of anything that's been a responsibility of the state in that regard. Part of the overhead costs that go to support this program, the nonprofits are allowed to use some percentage of that to support overhead, and they do purchase for all the nonprofits an insurance policy that covers the malfeasance or claims against the program. I don't think the state has realized any liability or any significant liability that I'm aware of in that regard. The premium seems to take care of that, although there have been some claims.
Thank you.
We have a couple of questions, but we're going to change tapes.
Yeah, please.